Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. We welcome our listening audience, both on the radio and online, and we invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure today to introduce our speaker, Professor Rick Banks, Professor of Law at Stanford, and the author of Is Marriage for White People? A great quote that he took from a young boy who was asked about marriage and how applicable it was. But the idea that we have here of marriage in the 21st century is much broader than that. What is happening to this institution, which you know has been so prominent for so long and so many people say that we can't live without it? And, of course, at many times in the past. It has been in many, many different forms and many different forms of use, et cetera. So I think it's a fascinating conjunction of a very ancient institution with a modern democracy, everyone having more freedom to make their choices, and what that collision means. And Professor Banks has done a very fascinating study about it. His book is excellent. And if anybody's interested in the book after the speech, it's available for sale. It won't be right outside this. It'll be over outside the other one because they're selling the books there, too. They have one person to sell books. So be patient. But that's where they are. The books are out there. And Professor Banks will stay after and sign copies if you'd like. So, Professor Banks.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. This is one of the few what I call long-form events I've done. Most of the media for this has been much shorter. Even things that seem to be an hour, actually only 40 minutes once they put in all the commercials and everything. So it's a pleasure to be here. I'll try to set the stage, and then hopefully we can have a lot of conversation. So I always get a lot of questions about this title. I'll explain that later. For now, know that this is a book that began as an academic book, then became a more popular book. The central issue is how marriage is changing in American society. Marriage has evolved throughout the millennia, but it's fair to say, and most observers would agree, that the changes we're seeing now are, to say the least, unprecedented. We have never seen marriage change as much, as substantially, in as short a time as we have during the last half century. There are two changes that I focus on in my book. One is that the institution of marriage itself has gone from being what I call a necessity to a luxury. In 1950, which is sort of my starting point, marriage was socially obligatory. Everyone married. They married young. And they had lots of children. Now that world seems ages ago. And I'll read small, short portions of the book because I can't resist, frankly, which illustrates some of these ideas. So here's a brief excerpt that illustrates how marriage has changed. The change in rules of divorce exemplified the relaxation of restrictions that had long governed marriage. In 1956, a Pennsylvania court declared, quote, "The fact that married people do not get along well does not justify a divorce." Mr. and Mrs. Rankin wanted to divorce and introduced evidence that Mr. Rankin had threatened his wife with a gun and that she had spit in his face, threw hot water on him, and nearly slashed him with a butcher knife. Yet the court denied the petition for divorce, reasoning that, quote, "testimony which proves merely an unhappy union, the parties being high-strung temperamentally and unsuited to each other, and neither being wholly innocent of the causes which resulted in the failure of their marriage, is insufficient reason to sustain a decree of divorce. If both are equally at fault, neither can be said to be the innocent and injured spouse, and the law will leave them where they put themselves," which is to say, married. This was not atypical. Until 1970, and California began this change, until 1970, a spouse wanting divorce had to show two things. One was that the other spouse was at fault, that they breached the marital contract in some way, that they had committed cruelty or they had abandoned the spouse or had committed adultery. And then second, they had to show that they were innocent, that they did no wrong. So now the Rankins could each show that the other was at fault, but neither could show that the other was innocent. And under the law of divorce that had prevailed throughout the nation, neither, therefore, was entitled to a divorce. Of course, these rules had to change because we couldn't keep people married if they didn't want to be married. And beginning in the 70s, these rules moved from fault-based divorce to no-fault divorce to what's more appropriately called unilateral divorce, which is a system which we have now where any party can divorce practically for any reason or no reason. I have a friend who's getting divorced, and I asked him why. And they have children. They've been married a while. And he basically said, oh, I'm just not feeling it. And I said, well, what do you mean? I mean, we're just not feeling it anymore, right? Time had passed. They'd grown in different directions. He wanted to live his life a little differently than she wanted to live her life. And that is sufficient for a divorce. In 1950, that would not have been. Right. So I tell this story to illustrate the dramatic way in which our understanding of marriage has changed. And that changed understanding is reflected in the law. Along with that changed understanding have been a whole other set of legal changes, which have also made marriage less of a necessity. In the 1950s, at the time that this couple applied for their divorce, it was actually illegal in many states to live together without being married. It was illegal to have sex without being married. If you had children without being married, the father had no legal or little legal relationship with those children. So we had a whole set of rules that reflected a cultural imperative for marriage. Now we've relaxed that cultural imperative. People have children without being married. I'm told that some people even have sex without being married. Even if they don't plan to have children. Our attitudes toward marriage have changed. One paradoxical consequence, perhaps, of this shift is that as marriage has become less of a necessity, it's become a more desired social good. Marriage is no longer essential, but it's more of a luxury now. And like all luxuries, it's something that people crave and they want it. And they think that having it will make them happy, that having it will signal that they've attained a certain status that should be respected by others and bring them personal fulfillment. That's how marriage has shifted in our society. The expectations of marriage, in other words, have risen. People now expect more, it's fair to say, in terms of emotional fulfillment and psychological compatibility than they ever have. My father, who's deceased and who was born in 1913, he would ask I have three older sisters, and he would tell my three older sisters quite straightforwardly, or he would indicate what he thought made a good marriage. He would ask them questions if they had a boyfriend. He would say, well, does he hit you? Does he drink? Does he work? Is he reliable? It's a very short list of questions, which my sisters, of course, thought were bizarre because they wanted, like most people, they wanted a soulmate, right? They wanted someone who would complete them and leave them more emotionally fulfilled than they could imagine. And that's what most people want now, surveys tell us, is a soulmate or someone who fulfills their emotional needs. However common that is, and however natural it may seem, for most of the history of marriage in our society and in others, people did not want a soulmate. That wasn't what marriage meant. Marriage was a way of raising children. Marriage was a way of managing a farm or managing property. Marriage was a way of forming relationships with other families. But marriage was not primarily a means of emotional fulfillment and psychological completion. So now we're at a point where marriage is less necessary yet very valued, and that has led to what is one of the issues that's really at the heart of my book, which is a decline in marriage. Marriage is at a lower level now than it's ever been in our nation. People are more likely to be unmarried than ever. In part, this is because people are waiting to marry, because the bar for marriage has risen. It's harder to find the one. Because it's harder to find the one, people spend more time looking, and they're less willing, and they don't need to enter a marriage if it's not the one that they've found. So that's one issue. At the same time, though, people haven't delayed childbearing to the same extent that they've delayed marriage. So one consequence of the marriage decline is that unprecedented numbers of children are born to unmarried parents. About 40% of children in the United States are born to parents who aren't married. This number is up from 3% or 4% in 1960, an extraordinary increase. So that's one change, the decline of marriage that has resulted from the transformation of marriage from a necessity to a luxury. The other change, the social change, is one that involves economics and education. And that is that over the last half century, as women have moved ahead, men have fallen behind. In 1950, Mr. Rankin was no doubt the breadwinner of the family. The wife was likely a stay-at-home spouse who took care of the children, tended the house. Housework took a lot of time. This was before TV dinners and labor-saving devices. So marriages were built on the male breadwinner and the stay-at-home spouse. In the intervening decades, women have entered universities. Women have entered high-status professions from which they had once been excluded. And now women generally across the nation are a majority of college graduates. More women will graduate from college this year than men. Women are at parity or better in law school and medical school, still lagging somewhat in business school. But women have clearly made educational strides, and those strides are especially important because they're making those educational strides at the same time that the labor market is shifting to make higher education more valuable than it was 40 or 50 years ago. Right? So the labor market has changed so that people with advanced skills earn more money, and people without advanced skills, without college educations, they earn less money. The wage gap between high school graduates or high school dropouts and college graduates or people with advanced degrees is wider now than it's been any time in the past 50 or 60 years. And the labor market has worsened the most for blue-collar men. And this, again, this is where my family experience intersects here. I come from a family of men who worked in steel mills in Cleveland, Ohio, steel mills and auto plants, and those jobs don't exist anymore. The jobs that less educated men would have held that would have allowed them to support a family in 1950 or 1960 or even 1970 or 80, they've just steadily declined. Job market is worse for men without higher education, again, than it's been in many decades. So this change, the fact that women have moved ahead while men have fallen behind, has resulted in a shifting position of the spouses within marriage. Wives are more likely than ever to earn more than their husbands. In 1970, only a few percent of wives earned more. Now, one in four wives earns more than her husband. That's an unprecedented shift. Now, these shifts, so this is the universal story, the global story, or the national story. In my book, I focus on African Americans. Because these changes and other changes that we see among the general population are, in fact, most pronounced among African Americans. Marriage has declined for everyone, but it's declined the most for African Americans. The positions of husbands and wives have shifted, but they've shifted the most for African Americans. In other words, while some might view the situation of African Americans as atypical, or as an exception to what's happening with others, in fact, it's emblematic of changes that are sweeping American society. The same trends that we see in American society with respect to marriage and family, we see earlier and in a more extreme form with African Americans. 70% of black women are unmarried. This is over of adults. And more than 50% of black men are unmarried. These are numbers that are more extreme than for any other group in American society. And they're also lower than they've ever been for African Americans. As recently as 1950, the marriage rates of African Americans and whites were pretty similar. Black women were about as likely to be married as white women. Black men were about as likely to be married as white men. But since then, there's been a divergence. Rates have declined across the board, but the most for African Americans. Pivotal factor there is that as women have moved ahead, men have fallen behind. Again, nationwide trend, but most pronounced among African Americans. The starkest fact here is that twice as many black women as black men graduate from college. That's, again, black women surpass black men in college completion prior to white women surpassing white men. The gap has steadily widened for African Americans. Now it's nearly 2-1 in favor of women. We see that not only in undergraduate institutions nationwide, we see that in law school and medical school in particular as well, where the gap is approaching 2-1. Not quite there yet, but it's approaching 2-1 nationwide. At the other end of the socioeconomic spectrum, untold numbers or unprecedented numbers of black men are in prison. Estimates are that more than 1 in 10 black men in their 20s or early 30s are in prison as we speak. Right? And that is a problem in itself, but it's also a reflection of what I mentioned earlier, which is that men are getting less education, and they're getting less education at the same time that the economy offers fewer economic opportunities for men without education. So men who might have worked at a steel mill or in a labor-intensive manufacturing or industrial job 40 or 50 years ago, those men now enter an economy that has no place for them. And many of them, unfortunately, end up incarcerated. So those are the shifts that we've seen in American society, and they're most apparent among African Americans. So, and the question is what to make of these changes. Let's talk about the changing, and we can take questions on all of these, but I want to focus today for a bit on the changing economic positions of husbands and wives, because that's the one that is, very much remaking the family. So, of course, in many situations, it works perfectly fine when the wife is better educated than the husband, or when the wife is higher earning than the husband. And there's been a lot written about this change. In the long term, this is going to be a non-issue because most husbands are going to realize, as I think I've realized now, that it's really a good thing to have a wife who makes a lot of money. I want my wife to make a lot of money. And most husbands are going to realize that. And if women keep doing well educationally, women will become more accustomed to being the breadwinners. So we can imagine a world when my children grow up when it won't matter at all who makes the most money. The gender roles will be not nearly as rigid as they are now. That was the expectation that I had, that it wouldn't really matter who made the most money. I started this book by focusing on the marriage decline, but a strange thing happened as I was writing it, which is that my perspective on the world changed. And it changed in this way. When I started writing the book, I started by doing research, the way law professors do research, which is reading articles in my office. I teach family law, among other courses, and one of the issues in family law is how the American family has changed. And the marriage decline was one of the key changes, so I wanted to understand that. So I started with law and then quickly moved to psychology, and my wife's a psychologist, so I had some grounding there, and I moved to sociology and have a background in sociology, and then economics and history. And I was crafting a book about the decline of marriage. But then almost by chance, I was talking to a woman one day, and she had a lot of questions. This is a black woman who's a Stanford graduate. And she was really interested in the book. And I was like, well, why are you so interested? And she said, well, because it seems to relate to my life in some ways. I said, really? And I did want it to relate to her life, because part of the goal of the story at that point was to show how the African-American experience was actually emblematic of a broader American experience, and then also to highlight the experiences of middle-class African-Americans rather than focus exclusively, as most others had done, on the so-called underclass. So I wanted to highlight the experience of middle-class and upper-middle-class women. But as we talked more, it became clear that, you know, her life illuminated parts of these changes with respect to marriage that I hadn't noticed. So we began to talk, and that talk turned into a very long interview, many hours over multiple sessions. And one of the key issues in her experience was how to navigate relationships with men who are less educated or lower earning. Now, in retrospect, that shouldn't have surprised me that that was a big issue because, again, twice as many black women as men graduate from college. But I hadn't really thought about it much because not many people had written about that issue. People hadn't written about women marrying men who are not as accomplished as they are. So I didn't see that as salient in the research. But it was certainly salient in her life. And then after I interviewed this one person, I began to interview others. A friend of hers and a friend of theirs and then a friend of theirs and someone else who heard about it. And before long, I had more than 100 interviews across the nation with men, women, but mostly women, and mostly women in their 30s, 40s, and 50s, in Los Angeles, Oakland, San Francisco, Chicago, Cleveland, Philadelphia, Atlanta, New York, so forth. And a prominent theme in these stories was this issue of very highly educated and very successful women who were confronting a pool of men that didn't have as many successful and well-educated men. So then I thought, let me go back and look at the data. And when I went back and looked at various studies, I saw that actually there was a huge gap growing, especially between black men and women, and that this was reflected in the couplings that resulted, a majority of black women who are college educated, I realized, are married. A majority of black wives who are college educated are married to men who are less educated than they are. So a simple way to think about it is that of professional black women who are married, half of them have blue collar husbands. And half of the black women who went to college and are married have husbands who did not go to college. And I thought that's a big development. But I hadn't perceived that through looking at the research findings alone. It was only when I interviewed people and talked to them about their lives that that issue became apparent. And that issue was not as rosy an issue as I initially thought it was. Because many of the stories that I heard were not stories of, boy, we're happy that we can be flexible in our gender roles and structure our life as we see fit. They may have started that way, but in fact, there were some unique challenges confronted by these couples where the wife was substantially better educated and substantially higher earning than her husband. So let me give, and there are a few different couples who I use to illustrate some of these challenges. One of these couples is Cecilia and Daryl. Cecilia was a lawyer, or is a lawyer, in fact, in New York. Daryl was her husband. They got divorced later. He was her husband. He was a construction worker, and they met at a family-related event because their families knew each other from childhood. They get married. He moves to New York. They're prepared for a wonderful life where they pay no heed to traditional gender roles. But it didn't quite work out that way. So let me just read this segment about their experience. 3 children and 5 years after saying I do, Cecilia and Daryl divorced. From early on, they had conflicts about a common source of marital disagreement, money. After Daryl relocated to New York, it took him the better part of a year to find work. It was a huge strain on the relationship, Cecilia says. She didn't mind his being out of work, but he did. He was uncomfortable living off me, she says. It came to a point where I said, if you're this unhappy being unemployed, go get a job. Get a job doing whatever, but stop being so picky and go get a damn job. Eventually he did, but that didn't solve the problem. After he found work, Cecilia explains, the dynamic shifted from, I don't have a job, to, I'm not making anywhere near your income, so I still feel inadequate and inferior. Now, several years after the divorce, all she recalls about his job was that it was, quote, at a small factory somewhere in Brooklyn, and he was basically doing whatever, putting together whatever the company made. I don't even remember anymore, she said. While they were married, Daryl wanted to consolidate their assets, but Cecilia resisted opening a joint bank account. She repeatedly delayed and deflected discussion of the issue. When he became frustrated by what he saw as her refusal to give him a straight answer, the conflict came to a head. In hindsight, she owns up. At some level, she said, she recalls, it was my income, and I wanted to keep that control. As part of this whole wrestling for control thing that we had going on, she says, I think he didn't want to have to ask me for extra money. She required him to ask for money when he needed money, when his salary fell short. Cecilia never rejected any of Daryl's requests for money, but she did always want to know how the money would be spent. Those discussions were very uncomfortable to him, she recalls. But she thought it reasonable to ask why he needed the money and why he was coming to her. He thought she was treating him like a child. He was upset about the very idea of having to ask, she says, and felt that she was giving him, as he put it, the third degree. So one issue there is that husbands find it difficult to accept. Some husbands find it difficult to accept a subordinate role in the family. As gender roles have shifted dramatically in the past half century, right? It's okay now for women to work. It's okay for men to take care of children. But one of the gender roles that has shifted the least, the other evidence confirms, is the expectation that men should work, that men should earn money and contribute economically to the family. Even if the man doesn't care who earns the most money, I go on, he knows that other people do. Friends, family, coworkers might think to themselves that he's living off her, a sentiment rarely directed at a wife. And even if his wife thinks no less of her husband, it is difficult for him not to think less of himself. However sexist those values might seem, they constitute the social and cultural context within which many adults were raised. A woman who stays home with her young children is viewed as a devoted mother. But when a man does so, it is difficult not to wonder, when will he get a job? So this is about the pressures that the husband feels, right? The husband feels that he needs to earn money to be a man. But that wasn't the end of the story, because in this particular story, as well as others that I recount, it was also the case that Cecilia's own views played into the conflict here. Cecilia says it didn't bother her that her husband earned a lot less than she did. But the more I talked with her, the more it seemed that in some basic way, she did think less of him for it. It was as though he hadn't earned the right to make financial decisions. Cecilia, like other primary earning wives, operated on a model in which her earnings were secondary, additional income, what women of another era would have called mad money or pin money. This sensibility appears to underlie her expectation that her husband should ask her for money and be thankful when he gets it. Although she earned substantially more than Daryl, she did not have a sense that their earnings went into one big pot from which each partner could freely draw. Her money was, for her, hers. Not joint, not his, but hers. You see, she was raised, along with many other women, and this was extraordinary how this same sort of chorus came. I heard this from many different women. She was raised, along with many other women, to think that you earn money to avoid being dependent on a man, not to support a man. I started to wonder if these moms had a secret meetings or something, because I heard this from women who could not possibly know each other. But the husband's work was work that was undertaken to fulfill an obligation. The woman's work was work that was undertaken to avoid dependence. And this is part of why women's work is often regarded as a choice. Right? Because it's not something that they're obligated to do to support their family. That's the husband's role. It's something that they undertake for other reasons, to contribute to the family, to be economically independent, for fulfillment. And that's a very different model. Right? So in this relationship, as in many, we had a situation where the spouse's economic roles had shifted, but their understanding of their roles and their obligations hadn't shifted nearly as much. Cecilia made five times as much as Daryl, yet she still viewed her money as her money, money that assured that she would never be dependent on him, not money that she was obligated to use to support him. And that's a that was a common theme that came up in a lot of stories, and there are lots of others in the book. And it's also supported by research studies. One of my favorites is a study of how spouses spend their money. And this survey finds that when the husband is the primary breadwinner, when the husband makes the most money, sometimes they make decisions jointly about, they make all big financial decisions jointly. And then other times the wife makes the decisions, and other times the husband makes the decisions. And it's about equally split between the husband and the wife having final say. That's when the husband makes most of the money. So they split it. Sometimes it's the husband, sometimes it's the wife. But when the wife makes the bulk of the money, sometimes they make decisions jointly. But if they're not making decisions jointly, usually the wife has the final say. About twice as frequently, she has the final say as the husband when she makes the bulk of the money. Right? I can't think of a better example of the fact that, well, her money is, you know, it's her money. Whereas when he makes the money, it's part of a family pot. Right? So those are some of the issues that arise in marriages where the wife supports the family because the husband cannot. The narrow pool, this is the narrow pool that black women confront leads to another sort of what my editor calls the jelly in the donut of the book. And the issue here is this, that because black women have performed so much better than black men for a whole host of reasons that have to do with, again, the economy and educational system and the criminal justice system, because black women have performed so much better than men, there are few black men who are able to be the type of husband that most women want. Right. This is stable, employed, able to contribute in the way that women expect the men to contribute. So black women have the smallest pool of men, yet black women are also the least likely of any group to marry across group lines. Right. Black women more often than women of other races remain unmarried because there are few men. They more often have relationships where the partners in some way are mismatched. Again, lots of professional women, lots of working class men, lots of economic and educational gaps. So they more often have relationships where the partners are mismatched, yet they less frequently have relationships with people of a different race. And that was the puzzle that pulled me through the book, because you might expect that if there are fewer men within the race, you would actually have more women who would go outside of the race. But that hasn't happened. So I spent a lot of time trying to figure out why that is. And that is a puzzle, right? So there are lots of different pieces. There's not one answer. There are many different answers. It's not either or. Again, there are many elements to it. But let me give you a few elements to that puzzle. Part of the explanation for why black women are so much less likely than other groups to marry. Oh, and let me add to, when I say less likely than other groups, I mean, they're also less likely than black men to marry outside the race. Right? Black men marry outside the race between 2 and 3 times as frequently as black women nationwide. Asian Americans and Latinos marry outside the group 3 or 5 times as frequently as black women. So black women are, as we move into a more integrated world, you know, black women are the least integrated in terms of their relationships. And there are a lot of reasons. One reason is that some women I talked to, a surprising number, frankly, said that they just were not attracted to men of other races. And although I framed the discussion in terms of, you know, men of many different races, when the issue of interracial dating came up, many women focused on the black-white divide. And here's a discussion of that. For many black women, their desire for black men begins with physical attraction. "I don't do pale," one woman told me. "No blonde hair, blue eyes for her. But a swarthy Mediterranean man? Well, she had married one of them. Still, she'd say, I'm not attracted to white men. But she doesn't think of her husband as white. Another friend offered a different limitation. I can't do one of the ones with no upper lip, she said, pursing her lip as if to mimic what she found distasteful. These women erected no categorical bar against white men. They just didn't encounter many who made their skin tingle. For still other women, virtually no white man met their standard. As one woman told me in a tone that she expected to end the conversation, I'm not attracted to white men. But I couldn't take her at her word. Brad Pitt, I asked. Tom Cruise, George Clooney. But she kept shaking her head. John Travolta, Antonio Banderas. She kept shaking. And then I added, went to my favorites, Nicolas Cage, Sean Penn. No, 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 she said. There were no exceptions, black men only. She insisted that she never would, never could date any man who wasn't black. So what did these men lack that many black men had? The single syllable answer I got from many women was that ineffable quality more easily defined, more easily felt than defined. Swag.
I don't know.
Women know it when they see it. Will Smith has swag. Brad Pitt does not. LeBron James has swag. Tom Brady does not. But swag is not limited to athletes and entertainers. Barack Obama has swag. George Bush does not. And although unquestionably associated with race, swag is not, strictly speaking, limited to black men, nor possessed by all black men, because Bill Clinton has swag. But according to some women, at least Denzel Washington does not, unless he's in Training Day. So, and I still don't understand what swag is. But so part of the story is that women aren't, some women would say they're just not attracted physically, right? And this is something that shapes interracial relationships among all groups. But that's not the end of the story. That's the start of the story. Women also think that men of other races are not attracted to them, right? And there's some evidence for that. There have been lots of studies that show that when you poll men of other races or look at internet dating preferences, black women are not at the top of the list of non-white men. But it's also the case that there are lots of non-white men, so many, in fact, that even if some large portion of them don't include black women on their list, there are a lot of others who do. So then the question is, you know, why don't some of these people come together if they're open? And part of the story there is that, well, even when black women and non-black men are each theoretically open to dating each other, relationships might not form because each has a perception that the other is not interested. And there's a lot of evidence on this as well. That is that black women will assume that non-black men, white men in particular, are not interested in them. And the men assume that the women are not interested in them. And this is what psychological researchers call pluralistic ignorance, where each side is ignorant or misperceives the preferences and desires of the other side. And the insidious or pernicious aspect of this is that this can be sustained for quite a while when, as is the case with black women and non-black men, the parties are segregated from each other. So there's not a whole lot of communication between the parties, right? And this is actually something that can arise, you know, between men and women generally. I can't help but recall in high school when, you know, girls might feel like we weren't interested in dancing with them at the high school dance. But in fact, the boys were all huddled against the wall on the other side of the room trying to figure out if the girl was interested. Because the worst thing you could do is to make that long walk across the floor and then have to make the long walk back, right? So there's a lot of effort put into trying to read the signals and to see, is that a smile? Does she look this way? You know, is she interested? And, you know, it's easier to decode those signals if you're dealing with someone of the same race. And it's easier to decode those signals if perhaps you have an intermediary, a friend in common who can tell you, well, actually, she does want to dance with you. You should ask her at the next dance. But in the absence of those sort of signals, it's easier, perhaps safer, to just lay back, right, and not take the chance. And this is what happens a lot with relationships of all sorts, but especially with potential relationships between black women and men of other races. So that's the dynamics of attraction. Let me just put a couple other issues out on the table, then we'll throw it open to questions. The other issue that I was really surprised to find, once we talked about desire and people's preferences, you know, it became clear that a lot of times people would talk initially about desire and what they wanted, but underneath that desire, not even so far underneath, you could find that actually their relationship choices were shaped by fear every bit as much as desire. And fear takes many forms. Here's one form of fear. This goes back to Cecilia, who's a character who appears here repeatedly. Years before Cecilia had met Daryl, she had met another smart and funny man. He was a law school classmate. She relished his jokes and admired his intellect. Their relationship progressed from hanging out after class to studying together to sexual intimacy. All went well until they confronted that familiar question. What does this relationship mean? And where is it going? I don't want to have sex. I don't just want to have sex. I want to be a couple. That's what he said to her. And she responded, I'm not interested in being a couple. Sex, hanging out, that's all this can be. The problem, he was white. And Cecilia couldn't imagine, quote, bringing some white dude to Detroit to sit up in my parents' house. She even told him, you will not meet my mama. When her best friend later asked her why the relationship had ended, she explained matter-of-factly, he tried to get all serious on me. I had to let that go. Only in hindsight, nearly 20 years later, does Cecilia recognize why she ended it. Fear. She worried about whether her family would accept their relationship. She worried about whether his family would accept their relationship. She worried about having biracial children. There was a part of her that, because of these worries, she never let him reach. Only now can she admit, had he been black, I probably would have been in love with him. These same sorts of issues arise. Fear of acceptance by family members. And these are justifiable fears, by the way. I also interviewed lots of couples who had been married many years, including one, I mean, many of whom are still married, but what they went through is extraordinary. One couple, for example, who now have been married more than 40 years, they married just before intermarriage was legal everywhere. They met, she was white, he's black. They met in the Midwest through a church group. Her father was a pastor at a church that preached interracial understanding and believed in bridging racial divides. So she went away to a church summer camp and met a brown boy that she really liked, at which point her father told her that she took that interracial understanding idea a bit too far. And he wasn't the only one who thought that. Once it became clear that they had a real relationship, which is to say a sexual relationship, the father nearly lost his job. Members of the church threatened to resign or did resign. The church's future became was in jeopardy. They received threatening phone calls late at night. This woman went to school with this boy. Her parents tried to take her out of school, thinking that if they could remove her from the college, she wouldn't be able to pursue the relationship. Through her own determination, she was able to pursue the relationship and remained enrolled at the college. They eventually got married. When they got married, though, a lot of her family boycotted. They didn't come to the relation to the wedding. Many of them refused to acknowledge the family. Even after they had children, there were some family members who were still holding out. Now it's 40 years later, they have grandchildren. The family accepts them. But that was a long road, the sort of road that not many parents or not many people would be willing to undertake. I talked to another couple here. This is a couple. Actually, these are both couples who live in California even now. In fact, another couple here who'd been married 15 or 20 years, a black woman and a white man, and she had never met her mother-in-law. And race explained why she hadn't met her mother-in-law. Even more, the husband had never met his father-in-law. The woman had come to California from Mississippi. She'd been back to Mississippi many times to visit her family, but never once had she taken her husband. She had taken her husband, but never once had she taken him and introduced him to her father. And I asked her how she felt about that. And she said, well, you know, I understand. And I said, why? And she said, she explained that her father grew up in a time where things happened to him in Mississippi that were almost unmentionable. And he didn't talk about these things, but he remembered them. And they were not things that left him feeling warm and cuddly, shall we say, toward the prospect of having a white son-in-law. And that may seem extreme, but that's actually a much more common experience than we like to acknowledge. And I see this experience again in my own family. So my parents are deceased, but my father, probably my wife is African-American, but would my father have been pleased if I had married a woman of another race? Probably not. Because my father had suffered on account of race in ways that I could not imagine, going all the way back to when he was a child and his family came north. We think of families coming north because they're pursuing opportunity. But in fact, my father's family came north from Lithonia, Georgia, to Cleveland because his big brother made the mistake of wearing a new suit into town. And when he wore a new suit into town, he was met with taunts of, "Nigga, you think you better than us?" And before you knew it, bullets were being exchanged. And before the sun rose the next day, they were on a train to Cleveland. And that's the way many people left the South. It wasn't simply because they were pursuing opportunity. It was because they were subjected to lawlessness and violence and cruelty that, in fact, threatened their lives. So it's understandable, perhaps, that people might not feel so comfortable with the idea of their children joining up with one of, quote, them. So that's behind some of the worries that people have. Another worry that a lot of women had to do with whether a man of another race would understand them as a black woman. And this issue came up a lot, both with individuals that I interviewed and also with couples, was this issue of understanding across the racial boundary. Some of the women let me read a little portion here. Some women worry about white men in particular who don't know anything about black women. As one woman says, "I worry that with the white guy, I won't be able to be myself, that I could never really relax, that I'd always have to explain myself." Indeed, some of the women I interviewed did have to explain themselves. One 31-year-old school teacher in D.C. told me she dated an Asian man once who was nice, but he just didn't get it. Simple things. "I was putting on my scarf before going to bed one evening," she recalls. "And he said, 'What are you doing?'" As she recounts the story to me, she rolls her eyes and cocks her head, just as I imagine she did with him. "I was like, 'Hun, let's have a little talk.' I told him that I cover my hair at night, every night." To his puzzled why, she responded, "Because it stays where I put it. And if I don't cover it, I wake up and it's all over my head." He understood, but it was a conversation she would rather have skipped. "It's easy to date a black man," she told me, "because he knows about my hair. He knows I don't wash it every day. He knows I'm going to put the scarf on." Many of the black women I spoke with don't want to have to explain themselves to their partner. They don't want to have to educate a man about black women, much less black culture. Just the thought of having the hair talk for some of these women made them tired, emblematic as it was of so much else they'd have to teach. Much better to have someone who already understands. So these are stories that come up in a variety of guises. One of the ones that resonated with me and kind of ended a relationship, basically, was a story of a woman who, again, this is from someone from California, actually, who had a job at a very fancy job. She said she was a student or just graduate. She's had a very fancy job at a hoity-toity women's boutique at the Stanford Shopping Center. And on the day the O.J. Simpson murder case came down, the verdict came down, she said that all the women in her workplace, all her coworkers, all the customers, everyone was so crestfallen that O.J. Simpson was judged not guilty because they knew that he had committed that crime. Now, she didn't think O.J. Simpson was necessarily innocent, but she had a much more very complicated set of feelings about the case. Aware as she was of the history of police brutality and racial injustices in the criminal justice system and having the knowledge that lots of black men who didn't commit a crime were convicted, she had all this background knowledge. And as these women became so upset about this travesty, this injustice that they saw, she felt herself getting angrier and angrier. And when she left work, she started driving home, but then she thought, can I talk to him about this? Because her boyfriend was white, and they got along well, but they had never talked about an issue like this. She drove around for hours, not wanting to confront this issue with him. Eventually, she did go home, and she did talk to him about it. And as she says, he was as understanding as any non-black person could be about what I felt and how complicated it was and why it was so emotional. But still, he didn't see the world through the same eyes that she saw the world. And to her, that made a difference. He could sympathize, but he couldn't empathize. He could try to understand what she felt, but he didn't feel it himself. And this, she felt, was ultimately a deal breaker. So that relationship ended. So those are justifiable worries as well, right? That someone from another race won't understand me, won't really know who I am. The issues about hair came up a lot, and they may seem trivial, but those are really just simply emblematic of broader issues about whether someone could see the world through the eyes that I see the world through. So let's stop there. I'll just add one more point to this, which is that, because I do say this is not an advice book. This is not a how-to book. It's a book where the goal is just to give information and to tell stories about people's lives that bring the information alive and to help us understand how marriage has changed. But that said, this is a book that ultimately calls for the rethinking of the role of race in relationships. And it does suggest that, you know, although black women have been the least likely for many decades now to marry outside the race, it would be a good thing for black women to have the same freedom to marry whoever they want, whether he be black or otherwise, to have the same freedom that other people do. Because part of the reason that the marriage decline is greater among African American women than among others is that although black women have moved ahead educationally and are very accomplished professionally, they actually are at a disadvantage interpersonally with black men. And they're at a disadvantage interpersonally with black men because there are too few men given the number of women. And relationships, we may think of them as shaped by love and affection and staring into each other's eyes, but they're also negotiations that take place in markets where power influences behavior. And a chief source of power is the options that each party has outside the relationship. And if we have few men and many women, men have more options than women. Whoever does better outside the relationship does better inside the relationship, right? And so one idea, right, to investigate is that, you know, if more black women, you know, entered into the more integrated relationship market, you know, that would result in some of them finding partners with men of finding partners among men of other races, but it would also result in black women gaining power in their relationships with black men. It would result in black women becoming more able to be deal makers rather than simply deal takers in these relationships, because the women then would generate options that are comparable to the options the men have. So that's That's the point that's got me into so much trouble with this book. So I thought I would just put that out there rather than leave it unsaid. Thank you.
Excellent talk and also an excellent book on taking statistics and making them real and also giving insight into why those kind of transitions in society can take decades, if not a century. But there's hope that the transition is in place. So.
My question was very similar to what he had just described, with the fact that the typical roles that we've had as men and women, fathers and mothers, have been true for 5,000-7,000 years of the man being the hunter and gatherer and the breadwinner and the woman taking care of the children. How long is it going to take to have an equilibrium? Another 1,000 years, or is it moving much faster than that?
Well, let me say, so I don't know that the roles we've had now, we've had for the past 5,000 or 7,000 years, I don't know that that's the case, right? It depends what roles you mean. The what we think of as a traditional relationship with the men being the breadwinner and the women being the caretaker, that's actually fairly recent, right? That's a role, that role-divided relationship has developed just in the last century. That's not something that goes back 5,000 years, right? Even if we go back 300 years, right? You imagine, what do people look for in a spouse? Men probably look less for a shapely figure and more for a strong back, because people were working on the farm. And on the farm, there was no breadwinner and, you know, stay-at-home spouse. Everyone was working on the farm, which is one of the reasons people like to leave farms, I've realized, right? I mean, really, people like anyone, when I ever, you know, I see someone who grows up on a farm and I think, wow, that must have been so nice. You grew up on a farm. And they're like, no, what are you talking about? So, you know, marriage has, it really has evolved over time, right? And the changes that we see as traditional are often changes that may be 50 or 80 or 100 years old. They're not thousands of years old. So how long will it take, though, to get over these issues? Well, I think that my children will not have an issue, at least I hope they won't have an issue, with their, I have three boys. If they have a wife or a partner who earns more than they do, I don't think that'll be an issue for them. That will not be an issue for them. What will be an issue, though, and this is a big issue if women continue to do better than men, is that the movement of the divergence in the experiences of women and men is actually at odds with what people expect from relationships now. And we see this most starkly, again, among African Americans, where you might glimpse now the potential future for the society. Right? So we can glimpse in African Americans' lives now the potential future. And what we see there with African Americans is that the gap that separates men and women is not merely economic. It's also educational and, to some extent, cultural. Right? Educational experiences generate sensibilities and reflect values and aspirations and outlooks on life that are a part of who we are. And as women move ahead of men educationally, and with that comes professional experiences and travel and all sorts of things that men will be less inclined to do, men and women do grow farther apart culturally, if you will. And that can make marriage difficult, because one of the expectations that we have of marriage now, again, is that of marrying a peer. I mean, the soulmate is always your peer, right? Because they, you know, they're the one that you were torn from, and now you're joined back together and you're complete. So we have an expectation now of emotional compatibility and similarity that is in tension with the shifting economic positions of husbands and wives. So we need men, frankly, to be doing well, men of all races to be doing well, in order for families to do well. Because if the women outpace the men, then neither party is going to get the relationship they want, right? The couple will be mismatched, and that'll be a challenge for both.
Yes.
I think he.
Well, it sounds as though you think this trend is going to continue of more women being highly educated rather than men. But this is a very recent trend.
Mm-hmm.
And from my perspective, being much older than you mm-hmm. are, I grew up when this wasn't the trend, when many, mm-hmm. many more men were more highly
yep.
educated. And there was a huge push
yep.
for women to get more education. You don't think that there's going to be a push for men again to get more education, so there might be some more equality in
I hope there will be. I hope to be part of that push again.
Yeah.
So there's not a, there's no huge gap, right, between white men and white women generally.
Right.
But when you look at black men and black women, yes, there actually is a huge gap. There's a huge gap not only in education and professional achievements, but in stability and outlook and sensibility. And that huge gap does create problems. And that's part of the story why and there's research evidence generally that when we have these big income gaps between wives and husbands, with wives earning more, the couple is more likely to divorce. And then there's also evidence that African-American relationships are more likely to split than other relationships. About a third of white couples divorce in the first, or less than a third of white couples divorce in the first 10 years of marriage, but more than 50% of African-American couples. And part of the story there, I think, we don't have good data on this, but part of the story there is that the African-American couples are more often mismatched. And that's because, again, twice as many women as men graduate from college. So that results in matches that are just not good for those people. So if we have a society where twice as many women as men graduate from college, no, that would actually not be good. And I'm hoping we don't reach that point. Not because there's anything wrong with women excelling. I want women to excel. But we need to have men being able to flourish as well. He's got it.
Hi. Earlier, you said you would make clear why the title of the
book. Oh, the title. Thank you for bringing me back to that. Yes, so this title, this is a question. Is marriage for white people? I initially had many titles in mind, things like race, marriage, and inequality, or the dynamics of a changing institution, or cultural and economic influences on the family. And I had a research assistant who I showed these titles to, and I said, which one do you like? And she said, none of them. I said, none of them. She said, they're boring. And I looked at her and I said, you are very blunt. And she said, well, you have someone else to lie to you, don't you? And I said, okay. So I said, well, what title do you think would be good? And so then I didn't have a title for a while. And then I was thinking about this article that was published in the Washington Post, where a journalist goes to visit a class of young students, sixth graders in Washington, D.C., and the journalist is talking about being a good role model and talking about careers and aspirations and so forth and the importance of raising children and having a good family. And then the journalist says, how about if I bring some married couples in here to talk to you guys? And the little boy says, no, what are you talking about? We don't want married couples. And she says, why not? I can bring married couples in. They can talk to you about raising a family. And then one of the kids says, marriage is for white people. And that's where you just stop. And you stop there because this little boy, an 11-year-old, expresses more starkly than any of us could the fact that in his world, marriage had declined so much among African Americans that he didn't think it was something black people did. He thought it was only something, and this is in Southeast Washington, D.C., he thought it was only something that white people did. So I took that statement because it does have that arresting emotional impact and made it into a question. Is marriage for white people but not for black people? But then it also has another meaning, which is marriage even for white people? So it connects the experience of African Americans to a more universal or society-wide experience. Because marriage has declined for everyone, right? There are more white women who are unmarried now than ever, right? If we, and that's a real development that's monumentally important, but it's declined the most for African Americans. So I wanted the title to have that emotional, visceral quality and to capture both the African American marriage decline and the more general marriage decline in society and connect them so that I could then use the African American decline as a representative development rather than an atypical one.
I want another example, similar experience as lawyers. It will give another example, a totally different issue, but the same reaction. I worked with a colleague, a female lawyer in New York, for many years, and at one point she decided to throw away all her law school books, you know, 10 years after she'd been there. So she threw them all away, and she was living in the basement of a house in Brooklyn, as a lot of people in New York do. And about a month later, she found out from the landlord that the 10-year-old boy who lived upstairs had taken all the law books out of the garbage and had been reading them. And after he'd been reading them for a while, thought it was very interesting, he asked his father, "Do they let boys do that too?"
That's a good one.